Daniel, and to the sixth chapter of Daniel, but verses 27 and 28 of Daniel chapter 6. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who hath delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So the subject tonight, the siege of Daring, and we're talking about the 18th of April through to the 28th of July, 1689, although we will be talking about other events on the lead up to that, simply because we need to spend a bit of time with background to begin with. The Battle of the Boyne, and you know the date for that, I'm absolutely convinced of that. It was secured by William of Orange, and it in turn cemented his position as king in both Britain and Ireland. But victory at the River Boyne would not have been likely, apart from, first of all, there being a successful outcome to the siege of Londonderry. James II, and I know that last night we had James I on the rostrum. We've come through a number of kings and through a protectorate as well under Cromwell before we get up to the length of James II. But he became king in 1685, and that's when a lot of problems began for the Protestant people in Ireland. He came to the throne succeeding his brother Charles II. James was a very devout Catholic, and whenever he became king, he immediately launched into a program to push and pressurize and by whatever method he could put his Catholic subjects into positions of high office within the country. In Ireland, his principles and policies would have been carried out by the Earl of Tyrconnell, who was appointed the Lord Deputy in 1687. What he did simply was that he went into the civil establishment, into the military establishment, and he did a thoroughgoing reformation, to say the very least about that. In fact, he overturned everything that had been in place up until this point. You see, at this stage they had been overwhelmingly Protestant, and James, as we are saying, he replaced them with his own people in the civil government and in military matters within the country as well. In fact, such was the utter transformation in the army in Ireland that by 1688, just 3 years after the king had got onto the throne, the army in Ireland was now almost 100% Catholic. One of the few places where Protestant soldiers still existed was in the city of Londonderry. They were there under the control of a famous historical figure, Lord Mountjoy. Londonderry, back then, had a population of about 2,000 people. The vast majority in there would have been Protestant settlers, and in the words of the famous historian Macaulay, the inhabitants were Protestants of Anglo-Saxon blood. They were indeed not all of one country or of one church, but Englishmen and Scotchmen, Episcopalians and Presbyterians, seemed to have generally lived together in friendship, a friendship which is sufficiently explained by their common antipathy to the Irish race and to the Popish religion. So it seemed that even back then there was going to be no indecision as to the beliefs that were entertained within the walls of the city of Londonderry. But be that as it may, this was a time of great anxiety and of increasing distress. Fear was on the rise. A number of activities were coming together, taking place within the country, that caused this collection and concentration of Protestants in Londonderry some genuine anxiety. And we'll specify these things in a moment or two. One of them was that a new corporation had been appointed in the city in the year 1687. Despite the Protestant population in Londonderry, this new corporation was predominantly Roman Catholic. It was their council. Corporation was their word for it. Now that caused great unease whenever they elected these men, put them in position, caused great unease among the Londonderry Protestant people. It did nothing to alleviate the sense of foreboding and alarm that had been building right through the country. There was a general feature of Protestantism at the time, from one end of Ireland right to the other. It was known, you see, by the Protestant people that the Roman Catholics were storing up pikes and knives. They had known as well of priests in circulation around the country, and they were stirring up anti-Protestant passions. Protestants believed then that there is a massacre of our people that is about to take place. They were no strangers to the massacre, because most of them could have remembered, any of them of any years I suppose could have remembered, back to the year 1641 when there was a great rebellion in Ireland and many Protestant people would have been slain. There's a little picture I got from a book that depicts people being thrown over the bridge in Portadown, and that was a scene that was replayed in many of the villages and towns across Ireland during that 1641 uprising. So this was one of the factors that fed fear in the hearts and in the minds of the people. They had this new council, predominantly Catholic, ruling over a Protestant populace in Londonderry, and they were getting all of this news coming in on a regular basis that the Catholic people are rising up, they're arming themselves, the priests are stirring them, and they think massacre number two is on the way. This fear and alarm was heightened by an order that came through from the military high command in the country. For years, Lord Mountjoy's regiment of foot were garrisoned in the city of Londonderry. Lord Mountjoy was a Protestant, as were quite a number of his officers, including the Lieutenant Colonel Robert Lunding, who later became governor of the city. Mountjoy's garrison, therefore, was looked upon by the people as our last secure line of defence, and our only line of defence, if you want to put it like that. But quite suddenly, an order came up from Dublin, from Tyrconnell, who was saying that Mountjoy's garrison had now, immediately, to quit Londonderry and withdraw to Dublin. Instead, the city of Derry was going to be garrisoned by, predictably, a new Catholic force. They called them the Redshanks. I was trying to get a picture or two of these Redshanks, and I felt, you know, the name has been so popular in history, I'm bound to be able to stumble upon a good picture of some of these Redshanks, and all I got on Google image search, page after page after page, of the Redshank bird. And so I can't show you a picture of any Redshanks, otherwise you would be looking rather oddly and wondering, had you lost track completely of what I was saying, if there were birds here up on screen. But these Redshanks were now to fill the gap that the Mountjoy's garrison had left open by going down to Dublin. Now, the Redshanks would have been full of Irish troops, Scottish Highlanders, all Catholics. Had they been ready to march, they would have replaced Mountjoy's regiment before it left Londonderry on the 23rd of November. But as it turned out, there was a delay of a fortnight. One of the reasons was that the Earl of Antrim, who was put in charge of the Redshanks, he was an old man of 70 years of age. I hope I'm not offending too many people here tonight by saying that, but, you know, he's in charge of an army at 70. And he was very anxious that he would build up a body of fine-looking men. He made it a condition of recruitment that every member of his regiment should be around 6 feet tall. Now, that took time to organise, and he scoured the country. And no doubt many people didn't get through on the draft here because they didn't measure up. And he held to that until he had a full regiment of 6 foot soldiers. But while he was going round in his recruitment crusade, it meant that Londonderry for these 2 weeks had no garrison within its walls. There was this fear of what was happening on the outside. There was no protection whatsoever. And in this period, another thing happened, which all of you will know will be the Cumber Letter. It was delivered to the city, dated the 3rd of December, 1688, warning of a plan to massacre the Protestants of the North on a specified date, the 9th of December. So the people, you can imagine the fear, the anxiety level has now been ratcheted up quite a few more notches. And all that they have been thinking of as being the worst case scenario, all of a sudden it seems that the specter of this massacre has so loomed upon them that they can almost feel the hand of a brutal death on their shoulder. The citizens of Londonderry were convinced that Antrim's men, these red shanks who were on their way, were part of the overall plan. They didn't have too long to wait to see the whites of the eyes of these red shank soldiers. A messenger, looking out over the city walls, brought news there that the advance party of Antrim's Catholic troops was only now about 2 miles from Londonderry. They're fast closing in. On the 7th of December, 1688, the advance force of these red shanks arrived on the east bank of the city. Two of the officers crossed over the River Foyle and demanded quarters for their men and food for their horses. Now, there was a little clerical oversight that meant that the warrants they came and presented at the city gates had been left unsigned. And this technicality was welcome because it gave the high sheriffs in the city of Londonderry a bit of extra time to work out what they were going to do in this new situation. Their arm was kind of pushed because whenever the people in the city heard that the advanced troop of the Red Shanks have arrived, they're negotiating, they're wanting in, they're demanding entrance, the mob was soon out on the streets and they were, as we have said, convinced the second massacre of the Protestants was about to start and that they were going to be the first targets. And so we come to that historic moment of the closing of the gates. These warnings had been filtering in from the outside that they should close the gates. A former governor of the city, who was now living outside, Broad sent a message in, and he was saying, I advise you strongly, close the gates. Don't let these red shanks in. Inside the city, the population was divided on the issue. The older people were very hesitant about closing the gates of the city against the king's army because, well, after all, that's an act of treason, as King James II is still our legitimate ruler and we can't dare close the gates on troops that he has sent. But the younger element, being what young people always are, didn't quite want to listen to the older verdict. They were all for closing the gates and chancing the consequences. Let's have a bit of excitement and adventure, and to boot, let's protect our lives here. They were still debating what they would do whenever they noticed that the vanguard of this regiment, three companies now, that was totaling 150 men out of a force of 1,200 soldiers, they had started to cross over the River Foyle by ferry. They were heading towards a landing place at Fergiegate, just 300 yards from the walls of the city. It was at this moment that the famous 13 apprentice boys made their decision, a decision which, according to C.D. Milligan, was to prove momentous for Protestantism in Ireland, important for the future of England and Scotland, and fatal for James. These 13 apprentices were led by Henry Campsing. They drew their swords, they ran to the main guard, they wrestled the keys off them, rushed over to this Fergiegate, drew up the drawbridge, and locked the gates. The Red Shanks were within 60 yards of the gate when the drawbridge comes up in their faces. The apprentice boys then hurried around the other three gates of the city, Bishop's Gate, Butcher's Gate, and the Shipkey Gate, and they locked them and secured those as well. Now the Red Shanks outside are absolutely dumbfounded, and they're standing around in huddles, and they're wondering, what do we do here? Two of their officers are inside the walls trying to negotiate their entrance. They're now locked out, and it doesn't look as if the men inside are in any mood to let them in. James Morrison, who was standing on the ramparts near the Fergie Gate when it was closed, shouted at the soldiers outside to go away. And when they continued to hesitate, he called out, bring about a great gun here. And that, believe it or not, settled the issue. Antrim's troops made their way back to the ferry, and cross back over the River Foyle. Inside the city, the debate continued. Should we let these men in, or should we do what we have done at this moment in time, keep them out? They had a meeting in the town hall, and they had the major Protestants in the sitting in attendance. The deputy mayor was there. The members of the corporation were there. The Bishop of Derry, Dr. Ezekiel Hopkins, was there. And other prominent citizens were also present. Now, I have a lot of time for Ezekiel Hopkins as a writer on spiritual themes. He was, after all, one of those recognized to be a Puritan preacher. But he wasn't giving good advice on this occasion. Not only the deputy mayor was in favor of letting the soldiers into the city, but the bishop was arguing the case and saying, yes, we ought to let Antrim's men in. But the majority within the town hall that day, they were firmly resolved that we are going to resist. Those gates will not be open. The bishop stood and made a very flowery speech, a lot of persuasive language, trying to impress upon them how these gates must be open and they can't dare resist in the way they're doing against the king. Somebody stood up and said, your sermon is very good, sir, but we haven't the time to listen to it now. Hopkins left the city the next day, went to Rathfoyle, and from there he made his way over to England. They formed a citizens' committee to plan the defence of the town, and support poured in from the surrounding countryside. From this time on until the end of the siege, many parties and groups of Protestant refugees, some of them that were pretty useful fighting men, so they were very welcome into the city, but others, just another collection of hungry mouths, more mouths to feed, they constantly arrived in the city. I think the impression is often given by some smaller accounts of the siege that as soon as those gates were closed, the gates remained closed on this, from the 7th of December through to the end of the siege. They were never opened again until the day of relief. But that's not the case. There was constant traffic in and out. Not only during the phony siege on the way up to the real siege, but even when the city was in the last stages of its extremity and many people were dying in every side, those gates were still being opened and closed and people were coming in and others going out. The 9th of December was a key date. That was the day when this great massacre was meant to take place. The morning dawned, nothing happened, except for the fact that news came into the city of Londonderry that was welcomed by then and lifted a cheer. King James' daughter, Anne, the Princess of Denmark, she was the future Queen of England as well, she had announced that she was giving her support to William of Orange cause. And this news was greeted not just by a cheer, but by the firing of two great guns from the city of Londonderry. Back on the 5th of November, 1688, King William III had landed at Torbay. That was another reason, I suppose, to celebrate the date. We thought about that last night on the gunpowder plot trail, the 5th of November, but it was also the date when William of Orange came to England. And he marches up towards London, and more of England's prominent families and nobility and many of James' former generals and many courtiers as well went over to William's side, including the best officer that James had in his army, Lord Churchill, later the Duke of Marlborough. With every day that passed, the kingdom was very distinctively going away from James' grasp. His chances of regaining it were quickly diminishing. And the news here that his younger daughter Anne had given her blessing to William's cause must have seemed to James like the final straw, because that was two of his daughters now ranged against him. His elder daughter Mary was, after all, married to William of Orange. Even so, inside the city, tension was rising. George Philip, a former governor of the city, was readmitted through that gate and reappointed governor. He had, for his pleasure, the keys of the city given to him, and also the keys of the magazine were handed over to him. That wouldn't have yielded much of a fruitful result, because when he'd have opened the magazine at that time, there was one barrel of gunpowder, and that was about it. So they weren't having a lot of material here whereby they could have repelled Antrim's forces outside. The citizens composed letters and they sent them out appealing for help. One they sent to Lord Mountjoy, their former soldier who was in charge of the garrison, who was now in Dublin. They sent a letter to him explaining what had happened in the city, how the gates had been closed, and the young people, with a bit of enthusiasm, had got up and they had gone against the counsel of the older and the wiser heads in it. They were playing their cards here very carefully and phrasing the letter so that they were not going to be blamed for staging a full-orbed revolt at this stage. They were trying to curry favour in a lot of quarters, and so they worded the letters very carefully. And to Mountjoy they said to him, "But we have resolved to stand upon our guard and to defend our walls, and not to admit any peepishes whatsoever to quarter among us." David Cairns would have been a big figure in the city at this time. He was sent with another letter over to London to the Irish Society to see if he could find some assistance from that quarter. So the morning of the 9th of December has passed. And if we can get back to that day, the evening comes on the 9th of December. And there's still the tension in the air. In fact, in every Protestant house, there was hardly a place where there wasn't a light burning, and most of those had an armed man on guard outside the door. In fact, though Tyrconnell had called leading Protestants to Dublin, and he'd be issuing an official proclamation here that, "Oh, we deny this massacre. There's not going to be any massacre. That's a total red herring. People are just telling you that to stir up and inflame your fear and your passion." Even though Tyrconnell was trying to put out the message from Dublin, "You're safe up there, you're okay," right across the country, Protestants who didn't believe that message took measures to protect themselves. Many Protestant families boarded ships for England. Those who decided they would stay on in Ireland began to congregate close to one another. Many of the larger country houses scattered throughout the country would have been turned into virtual fortresses. 2 weeks later, 21st of December, the Red Shanks were withdrawn. And an all Protestant force under Lieutenant Colonel Robert Lunding was received into the city. Some major events were now about to unfold. James, by this stage, since William has landed in England, has now fled to France. James has gone to Louis XIV. He's been entertained at Versailles. He's housed in a palace 13 miles away from the king's own residence. He's given a very generous allowance by Louis XIV. He's received very nobly. And it's all done on the understanding that James II, when the time is ripe, will attempt to reconquer his kingdom. And Louis XIV was saying, "Well, Ireland surely would be the launching pad. It'll be your base to take back the kingdom." And this is what he tried. There was a general call to arms in Ireland. The flag in Dublin Castle carried the slogan, "Now or never, now and forever." And all over the country, the Irish peasants abandoned their potato patches and they flocked to the colours. The priests, of course, they'll be there. They continue to exhort their congregations to arm themselves for the day when openly they can fight for the Catholic faith. Take the country for James and take the country for the Pope. The Irish army that had consisted of a mere 8 regiments had now mushroomed to 48 regiments. And because they were extremely badly paid in an army, then they launched out on a land grab. On a scale that, bad though things are, terrible though things are in Zimbabwe at the moment, well, on a scale it happened in Ireland that Zimbabwe have not yet seen. This swollen Irish army took everything they could from the Protestant hands right across the country, and whatever the army left behind them, then many bands of marauders came and swept up. Every smith, every cutler, every carpenter was hard at work producing pikes and skeins and iron stakes with pointed tips hardened in the fire. Macaulay estimated that by February of 1689... at least 100,000 Irish men were in arms. One half of them soldiers, the other half bandits. It was quite impossible for the Protestant people to resist this kind of onslaught. Those fortified houses that they were taking refuge in, up and down the country, dotted all around the place, they surrendered. Their occupants were happy to escape with their lives if they could. But many, rather than submit, packed enough for their immediate needs, burned the rest that they couldn't take with them, and set off for one of two shelters, Enniskillen or Londonderry. You see, apart from Londonderry at the time, the only other principal Protestant stronghold in the north of the country was Enniskillen, though it was no more than a village, about 80 dwellings that were clustered around an old castle. Belfast at this time was simply a collection of mud huts on the banks of the River Lagan. So while the Belfast brethren may well cheer and talk about all that they did on former days, they didn't really weigh in too heavily here on this one. Whenever James II was over in France, Louis XIV, though James wanted his army, Louis was not so foolish as to give him his entire army. In fact, all he ended up getting was about 400 captains, lieutenants, cadets, and gunners as well as a few of the top-ranking officers, and that was given for the purpose of getting out there to Ireland and reorganizing and disciplining this wild Irish army. The chief command was given to Count Conrad de Rosen, a veteran officer. James II left France on the 15th of February, landed at Conseil in County Cork on the 12th of March, and the Catholic population joyously received him there. He was told that in many parts of the country, certainly of three southern provinces, the Protestants had been disarmed, they had been defeated, and soon they were all going to march north to crush Enniskillen and then flatten Londonderry. The month of April became the decisive month. David Cairns, who we've mentioned as being one of the chief men in the city who went over to London to try and gain an audience with some leading lights there, well, he did gain that. He met with William of Orange, no less. And Cairns was given an assurance that there would be help sent from London to relieve the situation in Londonderry. Cairns arrived back from London on the 10th of April, and he brought a letter from King William to Lundy. He was in charge of the garrison in the city in Londonderry at that time. The letter stated how the king was promising arms and ammunition, and how he was urging in a message of encouragement the people to prepare itself and dig in for a determined resistance. However, when Cairns returned, he found that Lundy had no stomach for any fight. Lundy's actions, in fact, over this period, read like a real catalogue of disaster, if not a charter for treachery. He had abandoned a Protestant regiment who were trying to defend Dungannon. Lundy ordered the evacuation of Sligo, another staunch Protestant stronghold at that time. Whenever he got impassioned warnings coming in that the Irish army is marching in strength on Londonderry, he said, "Oh, that's just a false alarm." And whenever the enemy did show up, as he was told they were going to, and they came to the waterside, and he fired a cannon at the Newgate Bastion, that was actually the first shot that was fired in the siege proper. So ineffective was Lundy's preparations that the gunners sitting on the bastion had no ammunition ready to return fire. When much needed help in the form of two regiments of soldiers sailed up the Foyle, reached the city on the 14th of April and anchored there in the bay, Lundy went out and met them, and he dissuaded them from landing. He told them the position in here is impossible and that reinforcements is only going to make the matters worse. And he advised those ships to return with their soldiers to England, something he said, "I intend to do when I get the chance." When the news spread of what Lundy had done, the soldiers and citizens within the city showed a lot of anger, as you could well understand. Many of the army officers said that there's no way that we're ever going to any longer consider ourselves to be bound to obey the orders of this governor. After dusk on the 17th of April, Lundy's friends secretly fled the city one by one. It wasn't too long before Lundy was out over the wall after them. The next day they convened a meeting, Lundy still about for that day, And they attacked him for turning away the supplies and the support that had come up the River Foy. While the meeting was in progress and they were turning strips of Lundy there and accusing him of treachery, all roads and directions, a sentinel posted on the walls cried out that the vanguard of the enemy is now in sight. Lundy stands and he orders them that there's to be no firing of guns at these people. But Major Henry Baker and Captain Adam Murray overturned that order. They called the people to arms and they said, "We will maintain our liberties and we will resist." And they were supported by the Reverend George Walker, rector of Donoughmore in County Tyrone, who had come from Dungannon, having been let down by London, and had taken refuge with many of his parishioners in the city of Londonderry. The Jacobites who came up to the walls on this occasion wanted to know if the promise that they had heard of a easy surrender that had come from Governor Lundy, they wanted to know if the promise was going to be kept. They were told, "Take back the message to your commanding officers that we have nothing but contempt for this Governor Lundy, who has made some treasonable promise to you guys." They were offering as well terms of surrender to the city as he stood outside. They were saying that if you citizens submit to James, your loyal sovereign, you would be pardoned. And that Adam Murray, who was the person receiving the message and doing the negotiations with them, he will be commissioned to be a colonel in our army and receive a gift of £1,000. Murray replied to that offer and he said, "The men of Londonderry have done nothing that requires a pardon and own no sovereign but King William and Queen Mary." When that was reported to James, he returned to Dublin and he left the siege in the hands of a French General Marmont. Lundy fled over to England. They put him in the Tower of London, had him as a prisoner there, summons him to appear before a parliamentary commission. He was ordered to be returned to Londonderry to stand trial for treason, although that never happened. In his absence, they had to provide a governor for the city. Adam Murray, they wanted to be governor, but he refused. So at the meeting, they came out with a solution of a joint governorship. Major Baker was chosen as the leading governor. And when he complained that all of these military and administrative duties are far too much for the one man, he was allowed to name an assistant, and he chose the Reverend George Walker, pictured there, as his joint governor. 8 regiments were constituted. Each man was given his orders within the city. Within 24 hours, the defence of Londonderry, with the personnel and the material that they had on hand, was complete. They were now an organised band. Those who wanted to leave the city were allowed to go. The old went and the very young went and many of the sick went. 20,000 people remained within the walls, and if you were to go around and draw a line around the city walls, you still wouldn't have covered 1 mile. It was so constricted a space. Within the 20,000, you'd have about 7,000 men able to fight and 341 officers. And with this action, turning the king away and him going down to Dublin, the siege properly began. There was a major barrage that started on the 20th of April. Soon the city was in fire in many, many places. People who were in their houses were crushed as those houses collapsed on top of them. Cannons were finding their targets, and the city was easily shelled. First, the people were shattered by this horrifying development, and they hadn't seen the like of it before, but quickly they regrouped and they adapted to the difficult and the dangerous situation, and their spirit began to rise. In fact, the spirit was so good that on the 21st of April, the next day, Adam Murray went out through the gates, and he led an attack on those besiegers. A harsh battle ensued, and the general of the forces, the Irish rebel forces, Mamont, he was struck in the head by Murray's musket ball, and the general went down dead. This cannonball apparently was shot into the city. There was a hollowed out section in it that contained a message. outlining the terms for surrender to the people within the city. Apparently, whenever Reverend Walker received this message, he said, "Right, I'm going to the Bible, and the first verse I come to when I open the Bible," not a recommended method for Bible study, but open the Bible, he says, "the first verse I come to, that's the one that I'm going to abide by here." And he turned to Psalm 37 in the verse 3. "Trust in the Lord and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily, thou shalt be fed." The people in the city really believed that they were going to be fed a lot quicker than it turned out. A relief convoy was sent across the sea towards them, set off from Liverpool under the command of Lieutenant General Percy Kirk, and he was going out there for the defence and relief of Londonderry. His troop sailed on the 22nd of May, but then they came across storms at sea. They had to stop at the Isle of Man for a long time, and then the ship again had to shelter off Rathlin Island, eventually reached the Foyle on the 14th of June. In the meantime, the people in Londonderry, they're defending themselves, and they're showing a lot of stubbornness and plenty of courage. They're against a numerically stronger and a more experienced military force out there, but they have an obvious determination that is coming through. And they're going to hold their city, they feel, no matter who comes and besieges it. And while they suffer many casualties, and while they're now attempting to starve the city to surrender, these people are determined to hang on in there. Starvation tactics seem to be the most effective as far as the French-led Irish army was concerned. As the food supplies began to run out, distress became acute. By the 8th of June, horse flesh was the only meat that you could buy, and it was in short supply. Tallow, that's animal fat, was a substitute food, but even that was doled out with extreme care. Things became so bad that they were selling a dog's head, a cat, a rat, a mouse, a quart of horse's blood, chickweed, starch, just for the people to survive. In fact, I think this is rather amusing. There was one, let's put no bones on it because he had put plenty in his bones. He was the fattest man in town. And apparently he found a cellar, no doubt, to hide in. Because as he saw the food supplies going down and down and the people in dire and desperate straits, he reckoned, once these guys turn to cannibalism, I'm the first meal. And you can understand, I'm sure, his fear just by listening to the situation as it prevailed then. The people were much more daunted than the statues that are now stationed down there in Waterloo Place in Londonderry, but it gives us some idea of the dreadful condition that they were in. A lot of them were concentrated inside the cathedral. It didn't have the spire at that time up on top of that tower. They had a cannon mounted. That would have been one of their major cannons, shooting back fire across the River Foyle and onto the waterside area where the French and the Irish troops were. Hope rose whenever someone that was up on the cathedral looked out and down the Foyle, he saw the sails of Kirk's ships coming. And the message went in, we're getting relief here. Provisions, man, the siege will be lifted. On the 14th of June, they were really rejoicing. But that hope turned to despair and was followed by weeks of misery. Because Kirk came so far up the Foyle and then he stopped. And he decided it would be imprudent to attack the people laying siege to the city. And he stayed there, inactive, at the entrance of the River Foyle for several weeks. Famine really took a grip on the city. Pestilence followed in the wake of that horrible hunger. 15 officers died out of their army in the one day, and Governor Baker died some days later. He was replaced by Colonel John Mitchelburn. William of Orange, when he heard what was happening here in Loch Foyle, was infuriated. He decided, no way can this be allowed to persist. And so we got a message through to Kirk. By the 13th of July, Kirk received orders from Schomberg, the commander-in-chief of the English forces in Ireland, that he was to go in there and relieve Derry at once. The Mountjoy was with him, big merchant ship, The master of the ship was a Londonderry man, Micaiah Browning. He had a large cargo of provisions on board. The ship being part of the convoy here, he had angrily attacked Kirk, the leader, and the army for their inactivity, and now he volunteered that I will go, and I'll take the Mountjoy through the boom that the French engineers had built, the great sections of wood that were cobbled together and brought across the river to prevent the ships coming further up the Foyle. I'll go through the boom, he says, with my ship and bring succour to my fellow citizens. He was joined by Andrew Douglas from Coleraine, the master of the Phoenix ship, that again had carried a large cargo, this time of meal, from Scotland. The Dartmouth was a frigate of 36 guns under Commander John Leake, later to become a famous admiral, and he was ordered to accompany them to provide them with some protection as he tried to burst through the boom. On Sunday, the 28th of July, 1689, the ships made that dangerous journey up the Foyle. The Mountjoy's in the lead, and when it reached the boom, it steered straight for it. And that boom that was intended to prevent any of those ships bringing relief to the city, it was broken through. There was no more prospect now of starving any defenders of that city into defeat. And can you imagine, even from those emaciated figures that were within the city at this time, the joy. It seems so tame a word. However they could celebrate, they celebrated to see the fluttering of the flags and the sails of these ships as up the Foyle they came. The failure of the siege was a disaster for James, because that destroyed his hopes of taking the north, and it gave William now a firm base in Ulster. And as we said at the beginning, from the base in Londonderry, he went on down towards the south until the Boyne battle is fought and won in 1690. When the ships had come up the Foyle, they bombarded for three further days. But on the 1st of August, they went over to the waterside and smoking ruins marked the former camping places of the besiegers. They had cleared up towards Strabane. And the most memorable siege, because that's what it is, the most memorable siege in British history had ended after 105 days of fear and of agony and of distress and suffering, of courage, of fortitude, in the middle of great loss. And the soldiers over that period had been reduced from 7,000 down to 3,000 men. We ought to remember, and we ought to celebrate. We are right to raise memorials. We are right to pay tribute to our fallen, those who have nobly defended freedoms in our country for our good today. Lord Macaulay, in his History of England, when writing of the Siege of Londonderry, he said, "A people which takes no pride in the noble achievements of remote ancestors will never achieve anything worthy to be remembered with pride by remote descendants." And that is so true. But when I think, and I close with this, when I think of the siege of Londonderry, I think of a spiritual siege that's more widespread and sustained than this one. And it affects not thousands, but millions. Every soul born in Adam's fallen race. 2 Timothy 2 in the verse 26 tells us that the unconverted are all in the snare of the devil, have been taken captive by him at his will. The devil is laying siege to their souls. Sin is attacking them from every side, and they're giving in because the old nature within is the Lundy traitor that reaches out the hand of sin and brings it inside and allows it to take over. And as sinners under siege, we stand in desperate need of recovery. We need deliverance. Slaves of lust, slaves of passion, slaves of iniquity, we need delivered. The hymn writer Charles Wesley said, "Long my imprisoned spirit lay, fast bound in sin and nature's night, but thine eye diffused a quickening ray. I woke, the dungeon flamed with light. My chains fell off. My heart was free. I rose, went forth, and followed thee. We cannot save ourselves. Christ alone brings deliverance. As was said in the days of Daniel, he delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth. And if you're going to get the siege lifted from your heart, and if you're going to get the traitor out, and if you're going to be a free man in Christ Jesus, you're going to have to pray to the Lord to do that wonder in your life and save you by his grace.